Welcome to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is the Cleveland Orchestra under Lauren Mazel in a recording of Dance of the Nights from Sergei Prokofiev's ballet Romeo and Juliet. This particular movement from the stage production represents the strife between the two opposing families of Romeo and Juliet. And today on Music for Life, we are going to explore the vast array of operas, ballets, orchestral, and vocal works that were inspired by the plays and writings of William Shakespeare. In our Sounds of Scripture segment, we are going to see how Shakespeare himself was heavily influenced by the Bible, particularly its poetry. And in our Classroom Corner segment, we will explore what music education was like back in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. Today on Music for Life, the Shakespearean influence. As I mention at the end of each episode, this program is produced on the campus of Herbert W. Armstrong College in Edmond, Oklahoma. Shortly before this podcast had even started, Armstrong College opened up a sister campus in Warwickshire, England, just a few miles from Stratford-upon-Avon. Stratford is known for being the birthplace of William Shakespeare, so ever since that branch of our college opened and its students and faculty started visiting Stratford-upon-Avon, there has been a rebirth of interest in Shakespeare, a renaissance, if you will. And I am happy to jump onto the fervor over the bard, because there is so much about Shakespeare that relates to music. First and most obvious would be the many, many passages he wrote that explicitly deal with music. One New York Times music critic estimated some 500 passages. This critic writes, "Hundreds of studies about Shakespeare and music have been written." That's a quote that Charles Ogburn uses in his book, The Mysterious William Shakespeare. Ogburn writes, "He is said to have employed 100 musical terms. As in other categories of knowledge, Shakespeare's music is so much a part of him that its imagery stands ready to prompt him." But we're not going to explore those hundreds of musical references in Shakespeare's works today. Rather, we will discuss the impact he had on music history, his poetry and plays inspiring hundreds and hundreds of compositions throughout the centuries that followed him. His plays have been the basis for dozens and dozens of operas, ballets, and symphonic works. His sonnets and poems have provided text for hundreds upon hundreds of songs and choral works. So today we will explore the influence the bard has had on standard music history. But first, as we do with most of our episodes, we will begin with our Sounds of Scripture segment, where we survey the Bible's many references to music for a longer sweeping historical perspective on our episode's theme. Now, we will have to approach this segment a little differently today, since the Bible never mentions Shakespeare. But Shakespeare was known for drawing a lot of literary ideas from the Bible, and many of these references came from the Bible's poetry itself. It has been estimated that about 25% of the Bible is written in poetic form, and the majority of that would be found in the Old Testament. This Hebraic poetry stands as some of the greatest poetry in human history. It provided lyrics to the great music of ancient Israel, and it certainly provided inspiration for William Shakespeare. Two biblical authors stand out for their intricately beautiful poetry. One is the prophet Isaiah, from whom the English language gets over 60 expressions, and who himself has been called the Shakespeare of the Bible. The other is the psalmist and Israelite king, David. Notice this statement from Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister from 1874 to 1880. He said, "Who is the most popular poet in this country? Is he to be found among the Mr. Wordsworths and the Lord Byrons, amid sauntering reveries or monologues of sublime satiety? Shall we seek him among the wits of Queen Anne? Even to the myriad-minded Shakespeare can we award the palm? No. The most popular poet in England is the sweet singer of Israel. Since the days of the heritage, when every man dwelt safely under his vine and under his fig tree, there was never a race who sang so soft the odes of David as the people of Great Britain. Vast as the obligations of the whole human family are to the Hebrew race, there is no portion of the modern population so much indebted to them as the British people. It was the sword of the Lord and of Gideon that won the boasted liberties of England, chanting the same canticles that cheer the heart of Judah amid their glens, the Scotch upon their hillsides achieved their religious freedom. And that was quite a lengthy quote from Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister, from 1874 to 1880. So he saw the British people's strong Hebrew heritage and supposed that King David, the sweet psalmist of Israel, was a more popular poet in his country than even Shakespeare himself. But certainly it is interesting to see how much Shakespeare's writing was based on biblical language. One scholar counted over 1,000 biblical references in Shakespeare's plays alone. Another said a conservative tally of biblical references would be 1,200, a figure that I think could be doubled, he said. Shakespeare wrote at a time before the King James Bible was readily available, or available at all. The English Bible most commonly used before the King James Version was the Geneva Bible, and there is ample evidence in Shakespeare's writings that this is the Bible he mainly tapped from, though there were other versions he likely accessed as well. He knew the popular Geneva Bible, biographer Peter Ackroyd said, with a marked preference for its vigorous expressions. In their book, The Facts About Shakespeare, William Allen Nielsen and Ashley Horace Thorndike state this: Shakespeare knew his Bible. Several volumes have been written to exhibit the extent of this knowledge, and it has been shown by Anders that he knew both the Genevan and the Great Bible. Charles Wordsworth, a bishop of St. Andrews and a scholar well-versed in both Latin and Greek, wrote, "Take the entire range of English literature, put together our best authors who have written upon subjects not professedly religious or theological, and we shall not find, I believe, in them all united, so much evidence of the Bible having been read and used as we have found in Shakespeare alone." Ackroyd remarked that the Old and New Testaments were the most readily available form of sonorous language, and that the bard was entranced by the sound and the cadence. His early religious education was such that phrases and images returned to him when he needed them, Ackroyd said. The Bible became for him an echo chamber of the imagination. In these hundreds upon hundreds of biblical allusions, we see references to repentance, the sweet heavens, the sly devil, Cain and Abel, the Bible story that appears the most in Shakespeare's works. He references the pate of faith, the help of angels, the light of a good deed being a candle in a naughty world, and the providence in the fall of a sparrow. In Act 4, Hamlet asks, "What is a man?" and refers to a man's creator as "he that made us with such large discourse." That question comes from King David's famous Psalm 8, where he asks in verse 4, "What is man?" Hamlet is believed to be Shakespeare's most autobiographical work. This may indicate Shakespeare's own belief in a creator who made us, quote, "with such large discourse," unquote. Shakespeare, like the sweet psalmist of Israel, wondered why God would create human beings in his likeness. The quote from Hamlet continues, "Sure, he that made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused." Shakespeare knew that godlike reason wasn't for nothing, and he asked it in a similar fashion to the Bible's most memorable poet. In fact, of the 36 books of the standard Old and New Testament Bible that Shakespeare draws references, guess which book tallies the most references of all Shakespeare's biblical allusions? It is none other than the Bible's collection of poetic lyrics, that is, the Book of Psalms. This has been Sounds of Scripture. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled The Shakespearean Influence, and in it we are exploring the impact William Shakespeare had on the output of standard music history. Of the nearly 40 plays attributed to William Shakespeare, at least 20 of them have been the basis for about 200 different operas throughout history. That doesn't include the ballet music or the myriad of instrumental works inspired by the subjects of the bard's works for the stage. Speaking strictly of opera, the first opera believed to be based on a Shakespearean play is The Faery Queen, composed by the English composer Henry Purcell in 1692. The libretto, a libretto refers to the text of an opera, is an adaptation of Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. This opera had only been composed 3 years before Purcell's death at the early age of 35, but the score had been lost shortly after his death and wasn't discovered until the early 20th century. We're going to hear soprano Sylvia McNair sing Hark the Echoing Air. The lyrics of many of the songs inserted into the play were not taken directly from Shakespeare's script. The spoken text interspersed between the songs was. Christopher Hogwood conducts the Academy of Ancient Music in this recording. That was Hark the Echoing Air, sung by soprano Sylvia McNair, with Christopher Hogwood conducting the Academy of Ancient Music. It was an aria from what is believed to be the first opera based on a Shakespearean play, The Faery Queen by Henry Purcell, based on Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. Now, not all the operas that were based on Shakespeare's plays were in English. Based closely on Shakespeare's comedy Much Ado About Nothing is Hector Berlioz's 1862 work Beatrice et Benedict. One of the more popular Shakespearean operas not in English, though, is Charles Gounod's 1859 opera, Roméo et Juliette, with a French libretto. The most famous aria from that opera is Ah, je veux vivre, nicknamed Juliet's Waltz. Here it is sung by Ruth Ann Swenson with the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra under James Levine.
Rêve qui m'enivre, ce jour.
That was soprano Ruth Ann Swenson singing Juliet's waltz from Charles Gounod's opera based on a French translation of the Shakespearean tragedy Romeo and Juliet. That was James Levine conducting the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. Shakespeare's influence on music was not just confined to the opera stage. Certain of his dramas inspired composers to write instrumental music that was meant to depict elements or themes presented in Shakespeare's plays. Two of Beethoven's famous piano sonatas were nicknamed the Appassionata and the Tempest. According to his secretary and famous biographer Anton Schindler, when he asked Beethoven what was the key to understanding both sonatas, Beethoven supposedly replied, "Read Shakespeare's Tempest." We're going to hear a portion of the famous first movement of this Tempest sonata, which alternates back and forth between a slow yet foreboding atmosphere and more quick, explosive sections. Here is a recording by pianist Sviatoslav Richter. Thank you. We were listening to the first movement of Beethoven's sonata nicknamed The Tempest. According to Beethoven's biographer and friend, it was inspired by the Shakespearean play of the same name. We heard pianist Sviatoslav Richter. When composers write music intended to depict something non-musical, we call that program music or programmatic. And this was an example of a programmatic piano piece. Programmatic music became even more popular during the Romantic era. Felix Mendelssohn, at age 17, was inspired by Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. He wrote an approximately 11-minute programmatic orchestral work that he called Overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream. This piece was intended to be a standalone composition. At age 34, Mendelssohn ended up writing what's called incidental music for the entire play at the request of Frederick William IV of Prussia. I mentioned on a previous program how the Prussian king had attended a play where he had heard Mendelssohn's incidental music. Incidental music, by the way, is music written to accompany a play. Say there's a place in the action where music would naturally be heard, so the company would need a composer to write music for that section. The king was so enamored with Mendelssohn's music that he asked the composer to write more music for his favorite plays, one of those being Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream. And Mendelssohn already had music that would work as an overture to the play. But when he wrote the overture at age 18, he didn't know he'd eventually be writing music to accompany other parts of the play. So he tried to capture the action of the entire play within this one work, within this overture. Let's continue to hear this overture, specifically because of these programmatic references to things happening in the play. Those four woodwind chords we heard at the beginning were meant to transport the mind to Shakespeare's world of fantastic creatures. The high, quick violin work that followed those chords obviously depict fairy music. It is barely more audible than a whisper. Just before, about 3 minutes into this recording, Mendelssohn depicts the portion of the play where Bottom the Weaver finds his head transformed into that of a donkey. You can clearly hear the hee-haw of the donkey in the strings that repeat a two-note motive from very high to very low. Hee-haw. We're hearing this recording of George Sell conducting the Cleveland Orchestra. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are exploring the impact William Shakespeare had on the output of standard music history in an episode I've titled The Shakespearean Influence. That was the Cleveland Orchestra under George Sell in a recording of Mendelssohn's Overture to a Midsummer Night's Dream, an orchestral work meant to clearly depict elements of the Shakespearean play. Mendelssohn wrote this piece at age 17, but at age 34 he was asked to write incidental music for the entire comedy. Another famous example of incidental music written for one of Shakespeare's plays would be from the 20th century. Dmitri Shostakovich wrote his score for Hamlet in 1931 and 1932 for an absurdly satirical avant-garde production of the play in Russia. The play was largely dismissed as ridiculous, but Shostakovich's music was lauded by the critics. Later, Shostakovich was asked by a filmmaker and a good friend of his to write the score for a film based on the same Shakespearean play. Both the film and its music were well received this time around, and as lauded as the incidental music was back in the 30s, Shostakovich wrote an entirely different score for the 1964 Hamlet film. Let's hear one of the most commonly lauded movements, The Ghost. Joseph Stevenson writes about this movement in his notes. One of the most effective uses of the music involves the ghost of Hamlet's father. The director, he said, didn't want to risk the possibility that the ghost on screen would turn out to be a poorly realized or silly special effect, so he decided not to put the ghost on screen at all. Instead, he asked Shostakovich to put the ghost in his score. When Hamlet sees the ghost, the viewers don't see its presence, but they feel it in eerie harmonies and a subterranean gong stroke. This is Theodor Kuchar conducting the Ukraine National Symphony Orchestra. So that was an example of some film music written for Shakespeare's Hamlet from a 20th century composer, Dmitri Shostakovich. We heard The Ghost Movement, performed by the Ukraine National Symphony Orchestra under the baton of Theodor Kuchar. We've heard some instrumental music meant to depict elements of Shakespearean plays. We've heard operatic examples based on Shakespeare's works. But Shakespeare also made his mark on other types of vocal music. His poems and sonnets have served as the fodder for composers of vocal or choral music for centuries. Even monologues and soliloquies have been extracted from plays to create the text for standalone vocal or choral works. One great song cycle, or grouping of songs, that is called Let Us Garlands Bring by the English composer Gerald Finzi. The cycle is named after a line in one of the songs. The song is Who is Sylvia? This set premiered in October 1942, and Finzi had dedicated it to a fellow English composer, Ralph Vaughan Williams, whose music was heavily influenced by Tudor music and English folk songs. We will hear baritone Bryn Terfel and pianist Malcolm Martineau in the song Who is Sylvia from a 1995 recording.
Who is Sylvia? What is she that all our swains commend her? Holy, fair, and wise is she. The heavens such grace did lend her that she might admired be. She's fair, for beauty lives with kindness. Love doth to her eyes prepare. there to help him of his blindness, and being helped in habits. Then to Sylvia let us sing that Sylvia is excelling. She excels each mortal thing upon the dull earth dwelling. To her let us garlands bring.
Let us garlands bring, the final line of the song we just heard, and the name of the five-song set by Gerald Finzi. That particular song in the cycle was Who is Sylvia? The words of all five songs are taken from Shakespeare, that song from Shakespeare's Two Gentlemen of Verona. We heard it sung by the Welsh baritone Bryn Terfel. So we have heard some instrumental concert music intended to depict certain Shakespearean works. We have heard some vocal music where Shakespeare's words have been set to music for the singers. In addition to all this, William Shakespeare's stage dramas have also been the inspiration for several ballets. The most famous would have to be Peter Tchaikovsky's ballet Romeo and Juliet. Now, this Romantic era composer did not write this music as a ballet. This was conceived more as a programmatic orchestral work, like the Mendelssohn we heard earlier, meant to encapsulate the spirit of this tragedy in the music. However, choreographers have used this score as the basis for several different ballet adaptations. I've played a great deal of this work on a previous episode, but just as a reminder, here is the famous love theme from the work, and in it, the English horn is meant to represent Romeo, while the flute is meant to represent Juliet. Here is a recording by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra under Daniele Gatti. Daniele Gatti conducted the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in the love theme from Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, an orchestral work turned ballet based on the Shakespearean tragedy. This play also became the basis for ballet music of another Russian composer, but one from the 20th century. Music at this time was often quite different to that of the 19th century and the so-called Romantic era, and you can hear the contrast in this ballet music by Sergei Prokofiev. Prokofiev's rendition was a smashing success, as it is today. After experiencing a great deal of Soviet resistance and censorship of the work, Prokofiev finally completed the score and premiered the work in Czechoslovakia on December 30, 1938. The work consists of 4 acts and 10 scenes, but is made up of 52 separate dance pieces. There are several particularly famous dance numbers. One perhaps most well-known is the march-like theme of the Dance of the Knights, which we heard at the top of the program and on a previous program. Much like in Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet, the love theme created by Prokofiev is quite beautiful, heard in the movement Love Dance. Though the Tchaikovsky theme has somewhat overshadowed Prokofiev's, Prokofiev's is certainly not filled with any less passion and beauty. Here is another recording of the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. This is conducted by Vladimir Ashkenazy. That was The Love Dance from Sergei Prokofiev's ballet Romeo and Juliet. Vladimir Ashkenazy conducted the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Next, let's get into our Classroom Corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. For this segment today, I want to talk about what music education was like during Shakespeare's time and the era just before it, the Middle Ages. There's a healthy-sized paragraph in a classic music education textbook called Music in Childhood by Patricia Campbell and Carol Scott Kasner. This section is called Music's Historical Role in the Curriculum, and I want to read this paragraph for Classroom Corner today. Since the earliest conceptions of schools and schooling in the Western world, music has been considered a basic subject. The ancient Greek philosophers and later the Romans claimed music and the arts to be key to children's moral development. Through the centuries, Europeans regarded the study of music as part science in its theoretical analysis and part art in its performance practice. Musical training was considered one of the high marks of refinement in the Middle Ages, from the 12th through the 15th centuries. A musical education was central to those seeking to fulfill humanistic goals or striving to become Renaissance men and women. Journal accounts document the significance of vocal and instrumental instruction for children, not only of the nobility, but also of the rising middle class. By the time of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, the artistic expressive needs of children were as likely to be addressed through schooling as their intellectual logical needs were. Music instruction was more than window dressing in European schools. It was viewed as basic to the education of all children. This has been Classroom Corner. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we have explored the impact William Shakespeare had on the output of standard music history in an episode I've titled The Shakespearean Influence. We've sampled some of the ballets, the operas, the programmatic music, the incidental music, and even film scores that owe their existence to the bard. I hope you've enjoyed this particular journey through music history. Remember, our Twitter handle is MusicForLifePCG, and we can be found on Facebook at facebook.com/MusicForLifePCG. You can also find us on iTunes and SoundCloud, and rate, review, or comment. I'd like to give special thanks today to two research assistants who have volunteered a great deal of their time to help produce this show, Whitney Kelsey and Alicia Lancaster. Finally, let's have our dessert for today, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the program. I want to play something from more of the Broadway tradition, and this is fused with some jazz in this particular arrangement. This is an American musical by Leonard Bernstein with lyrics by Stephen Sondheim that was a modern adaptation of Shakespeare's play Romeo and Juliet. The musical is set in the 1950s on the Upper West Side neighborhood in New York City. The story is about a feud between two teenage street gangs, the Sharks and the Jets, both seeking to take control of the neighborhood. The story's protagonist, Tony, a former member of the Jets and best friends with its current leader, falls in love with Maria, the sister of the Sharks' leader. This is Somewhere from West Side Story, one of my favorite arrangements, arranged for solo piano by my colleague and dear friend Mark Jenkins. This is a live recording from right here at Armstrong Auditorium.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Music for Life, a production of KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.